Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Il futurismo è un grande movimento antifilosofico e anticulturale di idee, intuiti, stinti, pugni, calci, zappi, specchiatori, purificatori, innovatori e velocizzatori, creato il 20 febbraio 1900.
That was F.T. Marinetti, leader of the futurist movement. The speech was recorded in Italy in 1924, after the horrors of the First World War. Marinetti didn't believe in holding on to relics of the past. He was only interested in the future, in speed, in machinery, in violence, youth, and industry. He thought poetry could help citizens adjust to this new stage of progress. But he was also a proto-fascist who advocated the destruction of museums and wanted to fight morality, feminism, and all opportunist and utilitarian cowardice. Scientists, innovation, creativity and literature all respond to the world we live in. And when terrible things happen, they have to respond to that too. The impact of the First World War on society was unfathomable. I want to explore the reaction to facial disfigurement and how writers, artists and scientists responded to the horrors of World War I. I'm Neil Denny, and this is Converging Cultures. Roberta Cremoncini is the director and curator of the Esterick Collection of Modern Italian Art.
This is a drawing by Carlo Carra, Atmospheric Swirls, a Bursting Shell, in 1914, and it's part of a series of works produced by various futurists, playing with the words and trying to reflect the noise and the idea of war through a drawing, also through a sounds as well. So Zang Tam Tam is one of the symbols of the futurists, because it actually was the noise of the machine guns and exploding shells.
The futurists ended up forming a faction of the Italian avant-garde. They travelled on bicycles to the front line, turning their attention from painting to fighting. This sat right at home with Marinetti. While serving, he referred to his tank as his new mistress, and in a letter from the trenches, he called for a futurist orchestra to enact the sounds of war, with explosions and the voices of men howling, laughing and screaming. Roberta Cremoncini again.
I think the futurists were fascinated with the war because they were trying to shake the past, and then every artist in Italy, still now probably, they still have to put themselves through the ideas of the past. Their heritage in Italy is so strong, and the futurists were trying to be very assertive in the way they actually had to break the past. And so they strongly believed that the machine and the humans could work together, and also wise very much embraced the idea of war, because actually it was the chance to actually fast forward very much all the ideas that they had. And I think there is the idea in the manifesto is like throwing a very big stone in the water to make waves, to be able to move something.
Of course, Marinetti's romantic view of war was not shared by most. Outdated military tactics came face to face with machine guns and storms of shrapnel and steel. Many men were shot in the face, simply because they had no experience of combat. Frederick H. Albee, the American surgeon who invented bone grafting, described the soldiers' attitude on the front line as reckless. He wrote, "Men seemed to think they could pop their heads up over a trench and move quickly enough to dodge the hail of machine gun bullets." Paddy Hartley is an artist who works at King's College London. He has created Project Facade, which focuses on remembrance and memorialization, looking at soldiers who underwent reconstructive facial surgery in World War I, alongside Dr. Ian Thompson, a biomaterials scientist and device innovation specialist.
My name is Paddy Hartley. Much of my work is about telling the stories of First World War servicemen that underwent facial reconstructive surgery performed by Sir Harold Gillies. And a lot of that incorporates embroidery and digital embroidery in the making of the work. You could usually kind of class the types of injuries to a certain degree based on which armed service. So pilots and Navy men tended to be burns. With the land-based forces, it tended to be shrapnel wounds, gunshot wounds. So for those chaps, it would be any part of the face that could be kind of shot off, like noses, loss of eyes, loss of jaws. And it often wouldn't just be a facial injury. It would be a facial injury and other injuries as well.
Hi, my name's Ian Thompson. I'm one of the academic staff over at King's College London. And over the last 20 years or so, I've been working with Paddy on developing new medical implants, using some of his arts training and his ceramic processing training to create new devices for patients that are coming through our doors every day.
We would use a free flap these days, where we would take a complete section of tissue, say from a forearm, say from the back of the thigh, wherever it may be on the body, completely remove it from the patient, and with that piece of skin you would take a blood supply, and then you would move that into the area that you want to, in this case in the face, and we would reconnect by microvascular surgery the blood supply to that piece of skin. Going back over 100 years ago, Gillies didn't have access to this kind of technology. As Paddy's already said, he was the pioneer of it. So his technique was to basically cut three sides of a rectangle and take a flap of skin that was still attached to the patient, and then using the free end of that flap of skin, attach it to the area he wanted it. That would allow the blood vessels over the next couple of weeks, months, to grow into the end of that flap of skin. So finally, a month later, the surgery could be completed, and the surgeon would cut the last remaining part of the skin that was attached to the forearm. So the patient would then have a vascularized piece of skin hanging from their forehead. Gillies could then use that piece of skin to try and reconstruct the nose or part of the face or whatever it was that he was doing. So this required a huge amount of patience on the patient's behalf to try and cope with walking around with your hand on your head for a number of weeks, if not a number of months, whilst you wait for your piece of skin to grow into your forehead. But it's really Gillies' techniques of creating these vascularized pedicles that he could move around the body that really moved us forward to effectively what is modern plastic surgery today.
I can't quite comprehend what it must have been like to be sent off to war, that the uncertainty of not knowing how long you're going to be out in service, whether or not you're going to survive the war, then receiving a life-changing facial injury, being sent to an experimental plastic surgery unit, and you don't know whether or not you're going to leave with a face which you recognise, which your relatives recognise, and which will give you a degree of kind of comfort or security working and fitting back into society. Because a lot of these guys, you know, they had to provide for their families. You know, that's one of the driving things that Gillies kind of was thinking of. These guys have got to be able to slot back into society somehow. I hope I never experience that. I hope I don't understand that.
I think as a species, we work better under pressure. Not too much pressure, but just the right amount. And that's always difficult to judge, because everybody's just the right amount is different. And unfortunately, you know, the necessities of war and dealing with conflict means that we have to try and improve our conditions, our situation, and it stimulates creativity.
But despite science coming on in leaps and bounds, innovations were often wildly exaggerated in the popular press. Disfigurement doesn't just change the way you look, it impacts your identity. Dr. Susanna Birnoff is a senior lecturer in modern and contemporary visual culture and is the author of Portraits of Violence, War and the Aesthetics of Disfigurement. Her work looks at themes of embodiment and visual anxiety through the modern period.
It is really interesting to look at the portrayal in the wartime press of men with facial war injuries compared to amputees, so men who lost one or more limbs and who then were fitted with prosthetic artificial legs, artificial arms and so on. What you find is a very different picture. Firstly, it's almost always the case in this country that men with facial injuries aren't actually visibly shown in the press. So you might find very detailed descriptions, sometimes almost sort of gothic descriptions of their injuries and of the miraculous work being done by surgeons and sculptors like Francis Derwent Wood. But you rarely find those stories illustrated, and if you do, you see, you know, maybe an image of somebody with fresh bandages, no visible wounds, and no visible disfigurement. On the other hand, you do find a lot of images in the illustrated press of amputees. And you see these men sometimes at the Queen Mary Auxiliary Hospital in Roehampton, where they fitted amputees with artificial legs. Sometimes you see these men playing sport, playing football or cricket on crutches. So what you see, I think, with the limbless is an attempt, you know, again, this is partly at the level of propaganda, but you see an attempt to sort of re-inscribe these altered bodies with virtues, masculine virtues, athleticism, virility. Now, this doesn't happen in the case of men with facial injuries. You're much more likely to see them or read about them doing things like working in the Queen's Hospital in Sidcup had its own workshops. It had a working farm as well. And I can think of several articles that feature some of the men at the hospital petting rabbits, feeding chickens, making woolly plush toys in the toy workshop. There's also quite a lot of discussion about the fact that the face is a site of and a source of identity, and that in losing part of one's face or in having one's appearance, you know, sort of radically changed, what's happening is that you're losing, I can remember one newspaper article that describes this man as losing the visible proof of their identity. So this sense that you'd lost something that was uniquely yours, that could never be regained. And so I think, you know, the idea that surgery could give these men back their faces, give them back their identity, restore their humanity, was a very appealing one. With limbless veterans, who were also very often stigmatized and certainly had you know, the same kinds of problems getting their war pensions. So this is certainly not to suggest that they had an easier time of it, but there was at least an attempt to celebrate these men as war heroes. And there was an attempt, you know, in the press to suggest that the male body could be prosthetically remade, that it could be made whole. And that really does rely on this understanding of the body as this sort of machine-like thing with removable and replaceable parts. Now, if you remove a limb, but you can replace it with a functioning artificial limb, you know, that doesn't detract from the machine. It can, you know, as we saw with the Paralympics, you know, actually make that machine more efficient, faster, stronger. The face is not seen that way.
But people aren't machines. Hans Vilada's Iron Gustav was written in 1938 and chronicled the traumatic atmosphere of post-war Berlin.
During the four long years of war, people had become accustomed to the sight of maimed men. Otherwise, anyone finding himself unprepared amid these horrors might well imagine himself in hell. Armless and legless, trousers pushed up to show the thick purple or red scabs on the stumps. There they sat, the mutilated. Those with faces terribly scarred and burnt. Those with missing jaws. Horror upon horror. With perfect regularity, a man in field grey knocked the back of his head twice a second against the wall. 120 times a minute. 7,200 times an hour. And the back of his head was one enormous wound. And it was in front of such a uniquely wounded man that the lad had stopped. This man might have been young, but there was no means of saying. The whole face was an immense scar with terrible black edges running into each other like the frontier lines on a map. Of the lips, there was hardly any trace. The nose looked as if burnt black, Most horrible, however, were the shriveled eyeballs without pupils. At regular intervals, without altering the pitch of his voice or any accusation, he said over and over again the one word, blind, 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 blind. And in this word, blind, there was something terrible, something more terrible than a lament. It was like the soulless ticking of a clock. The word seemed drowned in the street noises, and yet people in a great hurry, in a very great hurry, stopped and put money into the hand held open against his chest.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50. Luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
My name's Lauren Barnes. I'm assistant curator at Tate Liverpool, and we are here in the Otto Dix exhibition at Tate Liverpool. I guess the thing to say is that Dix was a soldier in the First World War. He was a machine gunner, so everything that he was painting, he had actually seen. And that really reflects, I think, in the way he was making his work. So we have a drawing that he made while he was actually on the front. So it's called Stormtrooper, and it's this kind of vision of a soldier who's face looks kind of skull-like, so already indicating this idea of death or injury. After the First World War, Dix went back to Dresden, where he'd been based before the war, and he continued his studies and started to really try and establish himself as a painter. And after a couple of years in Dresden, that was when he moved to Dusseldorf, started to make a few sales, really started to make a huge series of prints and of watercolours. And this was also the point of hyperinflation in Germany, so selling paintings, oil paintings on canvas was not going to be a viable option for him. So in a way, this choice to work in these lower cost media was an economic one. It was something which was responding to that situation that he was in, but it meant that he made 400 watercolours in 2 years between 1922 and 24. So this was really the point where he was expanding his range of subjects and looking at these subjects from what he saw as the fringes of society, so sailors and people in brothels and people in circuses and people who reflected the way that life had changed in Germany after the war. So in the war etchings, Dix was trying to reflect, I think, the breadth of the horrific things that he had seen. So you get the encounters with prostitutes, and you get ruined landscapes and dead bodies, but he also wanted to show the effect on individuals. So this is a work which is called Transplant from the fifth portfolio of the war etchings, and behind it's essentially a front-on portrait of someone. Behind him you can see there's a kind of head of a hospital bed, this tubular steel bed, so he's kind of identified as being in recovery. The majority of his upper face is transplanted, so his entire forehead and his nose, the area where one of his eyes would have been, is transplanted with some replacement skin, we can only imagine, and his face is entirely given over to this this surgery that's happened. So I think, as well as reflecting what actually happened in the conflict itself, Dix was interested in these kind of individual impacts on people and how this conflict had dramatically altered people's faces, the survivors that were going to go on living after the war. I think it's less beauty than there really is something in Dix, particularly at this period, that is about provocation and is about saying, we really didn't want to see this, but now I'm making you see it, and wanting to surprise people with subjects that they did not expect to come across in this medium. I think that is really behind it. Kind of, yes, wanting to shock is very much there. This seems to have really, I think, there feels to me a conflict between the ways that Dix was seeing this work. So clearly this face is never going to be the same again. He's kind of drawing attention to the stitches and the way that there's this artificial structure added onto the face. But there's something in the eye that is the patient's surviving eye, and in his mouth, that there's some kind of dignity in it, I think, in a sense that this horrific thing has happened to him and he will never look the same again, but actually he's going to go on surviving and will be able to move on. I don't know, it clearly is bringing those two things together.
Faced with these horrific images of the war's impact on German men, artists in Weimar Germany began to experiment with merging humans and machines.
I'm Matthew Biro, professor of modern and contemporary art at the University of Michigan. Cyborgs manifested themselves in Weimar culture visually. That's something that I found very striking. Now remember that the term cyborg does not really exist until the 60s. So the cyborg was something that was not part of German culture, part of Weimar culture as a concept, but I discovered it as a visual image in both the art, the film, the advertising, and even the right-wing propaganda in Germany between the late teens and the early 30s. Okay, so the Dada artists, and I'm thinking of figures like Raoul Hausmann, George Gross, John Hartfield, Hannah Hirsch, used the cyborg both to criticize the old order, figures like Field Marshal von Hindenburg or the Kaiser William II, as broken, monstrous figures concerned only for themselves, stepping over and destroying their subjects, but also technologically enhanced figures that were very powerful, that controlled planes, trains, the media, things like that. They also used the cyborg to represent themselves as figures who were trying to understand this new world order. For this reason, they used a new technique called photomontage, the cutting together of different photographs, adding text, drawing, watercolor, paint, things like that, to make new artworks. So they were also making a mechanized form of art. So they were opposing that old handmade, more traditional form of art with this new mechanized form of art. So that was the first response was really as, you know, a lingering sign of the First World War and the destruction of the old order and the bankruptcy of the values that led Europe into the First World War, which included not only the rise of technology, but also the Enlightenment, the sense that human beings are getting progressively more rational, their societies are becoming progressively more perfect. That was shattered by the experience of the First World War. Because they appropriated imagery from newspapers and magazines, it also allowed them to be much more political again, which was also central to their understanding of the new Dada art that was going to be much more commensurate with the booming, buzzing confusion of the modern world. Not only was radio being developed at the time, but cinema really came into its own, and Germany developed a really amazing film industry with true artists and creative individuals contributing to it. Metropolis is a movie by Fritz Lang, which he started to film in 1925, finished in 1927, which bankrupted the main studio in Germany at the time. It was the most expensive movie made to date, and it depicts a city of the future. I believe it's in 2026. That the story takes place, where a small and pampered ruling class rules a large body of enslaved workers who toil below the surface of the city. The purpose of the cyborg in the film Metropolis is to serve as a warning for the dangers of technology. It is designed to show how technology enslaves workers, makes them subservient to machines, and so it delights in its own processes of manipulating images, which it foregrounds through various montage sequences. So there's also a sense, the more positive sense of the cyborg, the sense that the cyborg becomes a way for us to understand how technology affects our lives, and therefore a way of making us, allowing us to live in the world more in a more human, holistic, full fashion. This sense of technology as expanding our sensorium is also implicit in the Metropolis film, although, as I've argued in my book, The Weimar Cyborg, becomes much more explicit earlier on with the Dada artists who show the positive side of cybernetic augmentation more directly.
In the next episode, we're looking at epidemics and how artists and scientists tackle outbreaks of disease. The series is funded by the Wellcome Trust.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns. Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.